May it please the court, I'm Brian Little of the Department of Veterans Affairs, Office of General Counsel Group 7, representing the respondent R. James Nicholson, the Secretary of Veterans Affairs. My co-counsel is the Assistant General Counsel for Group 7, Randy Campbell. Your Honors, this case is not about the merits of Haas. This case is not about the Agent Orange regulations. This case is about the potential clash between two separate powers of the federal government, two separate branches, and how that potential clash should be resolved. As the matter comes under the All Writs Act, the petitioner, not the secretary, bears the burden of demonstrating that he's entitled to the writ, including addressing the threshold requirement of a clear and indisputable right. Here, that involves the court looking at whether the secretary's action in directing the board to stay cases potentially impacted by the court's decision in Haas was so unreasonable that it requires the court to exercise the extraordinary remedy of a writ issuance.
Did the secretary refer to Ramsey at all when he directed the chairman to stay the cases at the board?
I would have to look again at the order, but I don't believe so, Your Honor. Your Honor,
is the secretary's discretion to, assuming that that portion of Ramsey, the address 7107, is correct, with regard to the fact that some discretion exists for the secretary to stay cases, how does the secretary exercise that discretion? Are there any constraints on the secretary's discretion?
Yes, Your Honor.
And what are those?
The law is clear that the secretary must use reason when he exercises his authority, and that the exercise of stay authority, the stay cannot be immoderate or of an indefinite duration. And this court certainly can, when a petitioner comes before it and complains that they've been aggrieved by a stay, this court can certainly look to determine whether the secretary's exercise of his discretion was so unreasonable that it requires the court to exercise its extraordinary remedy.
But I take it that the secretary's position is that the court is without authority to direct the secretary to have that inquiry at the front end rather than somewhere down the line when some undetermined number of veterans are affected and they individually would have to petition this court. Am I correct?
Yes, Your Honor. The secretary has the authority to manage the cases that are pending before the board. And the secretary does not have to come to a court, including this court, and ask the court's permission to exercise his inherent authority. Your Honors, I'd like to begin by addressing...
Isn't that what he did in Niemer?
No, sir. Niemer is very different, Your Honors. With respect to Niemer, yes, in response to certain orders in Niemer, VA has either complied with the court's order while pursuing appeal or has sought a judicial stay of the order pending appeal. However, the comparison to Niemer merely reinforces the secretary's position that a judicial stay is needed only as to claims within the scope of the court's jurisdiction and its direct order. Your Honor, Niemer is a class action, and the plaintiff class is defined to include all current or former service members and their next of kin who are eligible or who may become eligible to apply for VA benefits based on disability or death due to disease or injury associated with herbicide exposure.
If the Secretary's view is that the ability to stay a case is limited to those cases within that court's jurisdiction, and that is contrary to what Ramsey held, why did it not appeal or seek reconsideration of that particular holding?
Your Honor, the Secretary, Ramsey was an unappealable decision. Ramsey denied the application, and therefore did not present the government with an opportunity to seek an appeal.
There was not a ruling of, I'm sorry.
Doesn't Section 7292 of the United States Code allow either party to appeal any interpretation of a statute or a regulation that is adverse to it, regardless of the total outcome of the case?
Your Honor, I believe that we filed a notice after Ramsey advising the court why we believe that it was not an appealable decision, and we do not believe that it was. And therefore, we were, essentially, the Secretary was put in a position where Ramsey changed the law. Tobler was the law and is the law. Ramsey purported to change that, but the Secretary was not given an opportunity to appeal that ruling, Your Honor.
Well, you certainly could have appealed it and let the Federal Circuit tell you, sorry, we don't have jurisdiction over this. The Secretary didn't even exercise what is the right to appeal, which is in this case what I appears that the secretary is trying to protect. Your pleadings, the secretary's pleadings here, are replete with the statement that we're not disobeying the court, we're not respecting the court, we're only trying to preserve our right to appeal. Couldn't you have exercised that right to appeal?
Your Honor, we do not believe that we had an opportunity to exercise a right to appeal of the change in the law that purportedly took place in the Ramsey decision.
But why would you not have allowed the Federal Circuit to decide that rather than make your own judgment as to what the law is with regard to the Federal Circuit's jurisdiction?
Your Honor, we believe that the law is Tobler. Tobler deals with this situation. Ramsey was an unappealable decision that purported to change the law, to establish.
Let's accept that Tobler is the decision. Tobler cites
yes,
to Ithaca. Is there any jurisdiction out there that you know of that does not permit an agency or a lower tribunal to stay cases so that it can manage its docket, other than the?
No, Your Honor. We believe there is extensive authority.
All right, accept that then. Is there any jurisdiction out there that has 7107 applicable to it or a similar regulation that tells the board, in this case, how it can proceed to process its cases? Are you aware of any other jurisdiction that has a 7107 or something similar to it?
I'm not aware of it, but
all
I'd
right,
like
to... All right, then go to 7107 and tell me why the secretary or the board has authority to stay cases, given the fact that this is an expression of Congress on how cases are to be moved. And I might cite to you that the only responsibility, or a primary responsibility, in 7101 is to conduct hearings, dispose of appeals properly before the board in a timely manner. And then 7107 states how you can move cases forward, how you can slow cases down. How does that give the secretary authority to step in and direct the board chairman not to fulfill that obligation?
Your Honor, I'll address 7107, but if I could just take a moment and go back to the question about whether the government could appeal the decision in Ramsey, and the answer is no, we could not. The government has to appeal judgments. It cannot appeal holdings, and that's why we were prevented from that opportunity. Addressing 7107, Your Honor, of course 7107 deals with the board's docket and hearings. And 7107A provides that except for motions to advance on the docket, each case received pursuant to an application for review on appeal shall be considered and decided in regular docket order according to its place upon the docket. Your Honors, with respect to what regular means in the context of docket order, if we look at this word's common usage, it not only means arranged or ordered per a legal principle or a rule, but it also means orderly and methodical. As employed, Congress wanted the board's docket to run in an orderly, methodical, and read with 7101, a timely manner. Congress wanted a board docket that was fair and reasonable, Your Honors. Congress did not say in strict docket order, though it certainly could have. Such an interpretation would lead to an absurd result, which statutory construction principles tell us could not have been Congress's intent. Your Honors, no court has ever held that 7107, that a strict interpretation, a narrow interpretation of regular docket order is required.
But you don't need a narrow interpretation. Regular docket order would allow the cases to be processed as they come in. Some are harder, some are easier. But they don't allow the secretary, or do they allow, or what is the basis for saying they allow the secretary to direct the board not to process cases, given the fact that Congress also talked about how you can move cases faster, how you can move cases slower, that this court came about after that, that this provision has been amended after that. What is the basis for saying that the secretary can step into an independent board and tell the board chairman to do it, or the board chairman on his own, if that were the case?
Yes, Your Honor. I'll address 2 points. First, while 7107 relates to how the board is to manage its docket, 7107 does not provide that the board's docket, which is to be regular, orderly, fair, and predictable, is not subject to the secretary's inherent management authority as the head of the department and as the official with the executive direction over the board and its chairman.
And if the secretary functions in that role and he has chosen to regulate under the heading of Order of Consideration of Appeals, as he did in 20.900, and he does not set forth any criteria for his discretionary use of his authority to delay whole classes of cases at the board, isn't he precluded from you doing that,
Your Honor,
by his own regulation?
If I could just quickly finish my discussion with respect to 7107, that aspect of it. Such a restricted reading of 7107 would be incongruous with both 511 and 7104. These other statutes establish that the secretary possesses the adjudicative authority of the department. So board decisions under 7107 are made on his behalf, and it would be incongruous to read 7107 as placing the adjudications made on the secretary's behalf by the board beyond the reasonable exercise of his management authority. Your Honor, with respect to the regulation, we believe that the regulation follows very closely to 7107. And again, there is nothing in the regulation or the statute that prevent the secretary from exercising his inherent management authority.
The secretary in 20.900 indicates in sub C that with regard to advancing cases on the docket, although it's not covered in 7107, on motion of the chairman or the vice chairman, a party to the case before the board can move for an acceleration. Later in that same regulation, he deals with conditions under which a case can be delayed at the board. Having addressed the secretary's role with regard to advancing cases on the docket, when he didn't address the secretary's role with regard to retarding cases on the docket, hasn't the secretary boxed himself in with regard to the exercise of his discretion?
No, Your Honor. What the secretary boxed in was the board itself, the chairman itself, their management duties with respect to the board. The secretary did not preclude his exercise of his own inherent management authority. And we don't believe that the regulation or the statute preclude that, Your Honors.
If this court were then to review the exercise of the secretary's discretion as you've described it, what standard would the court apply in reviewing the exercise of that discretion?
Because the discretion here was in staying cases that are potentially affected by a precedential decision that is on appeal, it would be the same standard that would be applied to other bodies with dockets, and that is the standard articulated in the Landis case of immoderate or of an unreasonable duration.
So the standard expressed in Standard Haven's products would be inapplicable?
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. I'd like to address that. Your Honor, the Ramsey 1 reasoning confuses the relationship between superior and inferior tribunals with regard to stays of matter pending appeal. When a U.S. district court decides a case and enters judgment against a party and the losing party appeals, the loser can request the U.S. Court of Appeals to stay the execution of the lower court's judgment. However, even if the appeals court does so, the lower court's decision is still a binding precedent with respect to other cases litigated in the district. The fact that the appellant has bought time for himself through a stay of the execution of judgment in that case does not affect the precedential value of the decision that he is appealing. Your Honors, only the district court could, if it chose to do so in the interest of judicial economy, exercise the management authority over its own docket and stay consideration of other cases pending before it until the case on appeal is decided. The appeals court could not order a stay of the other pending cases in the district courts. The same is true with respect to the relationship between this court and the board. This court has no authority, Your Honors, to order or to permit the board to stay its application of a veterans court precedent such as Haas while it is appealed. The board must apply Haas if it is to adjudicate affected cases, but there is nothing to prevent it, like the district courts, from exercising reasonable management authority over the cases that are pending at its docket.
Except 7107.
We do not believe that 7107 is a wall that prevents the secretary.
Just to get it straight, regular order in 7107 is viewed by the secretary as allowing him to stay the cases that are already at the board when he wants to go over and get a change of law in Congress.
No, regular order means that the docket at the board must be conducted with a reasonable, timely, orderly, and methodical manner.
But wasn't one of the examples you gave us that they wanted to seek legislative change over Congress in your briefing?
Your Honor, that would be an appropriate, that might be an appropriate exercise of the Secretary's authority to stay the cases there. All of the stays that we...
How does that comport with Congress's continued focus on timeliness of processing? Now, we all know these cases get delayed because there's only so many people, and some of them are hard, and you need to get remand for additional examination. But how does actually staying the cases and saying, I'm not going to process them, pending some change in law, comport with that? How does it comport with the authority to amend decisions that have been rendered because an interpretation was found out to be wrong later on? I don't understand how it fits within any of this processing.
Your Honor, I believe that you asked three questions together. I'm not sure. What would you like
to say? That's the advantage of sitting here and not there.
That's okay, Your Honor. What, just, if you just give me a question, I'd be happy to address it. But we don't believe that 7107 exist as a wall to the exercise of the Secretary's discretion.
How does staying the processing of cases that are at the board, where Congress has laid out a process and procedure for it to be followed, where Congress has consistently said that it's a timely processing, how does staying those cases, and the one example I'll look at, is so that legislation, pending legislation on the Hill, which may or may not be passed, how does staying those cases comport with anything in these statutes or regulations?
Your Honor, pending regulation is only one of a number of potential ways that the law could be enforced.
Okay, but you asked for one question.
Okay.
I gave you one. So how does it comport with it?
Okay. It comports with that because that is one example of a situation in which the law would be in flux. And
it's not in flux. The law exists. Somebody wants to go up to the Congress, 400 and some odd in the House, 100 in the Senate, one president, appeals and everything else that might exist on that, and they want to stay cases pending that change.
In such a situation, the Secretary believes that he would be able to consider exercising his authority. And if he chose to do so, the only way that this court could review that exercise would be, again, if a petitioner who believed that their case was stayed improperly came to the court as an aggrieved party and ask this court to evaluate the moderation and the reasonableness of the stay employed.
Does the Secretary know how many cases are presently stayed at the board because of the Haas order?
I believe the answer to that, Your Honor, is approximately 1,500 or 1,600.
All right. So what you're suggesting is that it is preferable for the process to have this court potentially consider 1,500 or 1,600 separate petitions to issue writs of mandamus to force the Secretary to process cases, rather than have the Secretary come to this court and articulate one time his reasons for delaying the processing of those cases. Is that what you're telling us?
No, Your Honor. First, it wouldn't take a number of people making the same allegation to the court for the court to exercise its authority to evaluate the reasonableness of the Secretary's exercise of his discretion. Secondly, the reference point that...
Well, is our decision in one petition binding on all other petitions? Aren't all those cases factually different? Isn't one veteran older than another, more infirm than another, in better shape than another?
But if the allegation is that the stay affects a group, and the person falls within the group, then the court would be looking at the reasonableness of the stay that affects that claimant. Yes, that would be the narrow issue before the court.
Or is the Secretary saying that the status of the individual...
of the exercise, Your Honor.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Is the Secretary saying then that the status of the individual veteran is of no consequence?
No, Your Honor, not at all. But what we're saying is, if I could respectfully disagree with your premise, and your premise was that the court somehow has authority to require the Secretary to come to it before he exercises the inherent discretion that he has. And that gets back to the fundamental disagreement between Tobler and Ramsey 1.
Let me explore that a little bit. I take it from your briefing that the position with regard to Ramsey is that the statements the court made in Ramsey were dicta and therefore not required to be followed, correct?
in addition to the fact that Ramsey conflicted with TOBRA and is therefore not binding.
Now, how are the statements in Ramsey or in TOBRA any less dicta than the statements in Ramsey following your analysis?
Your Honor, the same fundamental question was presented in both TOBRA and Ramsey, and that is, what can the department do with the cases on the docket before the board when it
disagrees? No, that wasn't the question that was presented. The question was could the department fail to apply a particular decision of this court, Fougere, as I recall. And the finding in Tobler was, no, they can't ignore it. The statement that the secretary is relying on was not even the statement of Judge Farley, but it was a statement of the Second Circuit that he commented on. I don't understand how you can rely so heavily on this statement in Tobler as the law, and then turn around and say that the very clear statements of holdings in Ramsey are not the law.
Your Honor, and the answer lies in this court's own jurisprudence. The case of Bethay, the case of Tobler, which state that when the court has spoken to an issue in a panel and a later panel decision materially contradicts the first, the second does not have the rule of law. The first does, Your Honor. And if I could address Tobler, the historical context of Tobler was that in the earliest days of the court, there was confusion over when this court's decisions became effective. But Tobler made crystal clear that the court's decisions are effective upon their issuance unless or until overturned. And any rulings, interpretations, or conclusions of law in such a decision are authoritative and binding as of that date. However, Tobler also implicitly recognized the department's authority to stay cases such as this one.
Did Tobler address 7107?
No, Tobler did not specifically address 7107, Your Honor.
Tell me, what's the contradiction between Tobler and Ramsey?
The contradiction that arises in Tobler and Ramsey, Your Honor, stems from the Tobler court's specific incorporation, joining in both the legal conclusions and the language from Ithaca College, that if the board disagrees with a court decision, it should seek review of a higher court. And during the interim, before it has sought review or while the review is still pending, it would be reasonable for the board to stay its proceedings in another case that arguably falls within the precedent of the first. Your Honors, that language, for the board to stay, implicitly recognizes the secretary, the department's authority to stay those cases. It did not say for the board to
just
seek
to jump in, it says the board, it doesn't say the secretary. I mean, there is a little bit of a difference. There's an independent body headed by the chairman who has certain responsibilities to the secretary. But in this instance, the secretary, who is a litigant before this court, went to the board, who is deciding cases and has a 7107 that tells them how to do things, and said, don't do it. Why do you jump from the board to the secretary in this instance?
Because, Your Honor, the statutes make clear that all decisions of the department are decisions made on behalf of the secretary.
Well, if they're all made on behalf of the secretary and they affect benefits, they're subject to review by the board. I think you overstated that. But if you take a look at your own 511, it says decisions by the secretary that affect benefits, and we have the Federal Circuit that told us that's pretty broad in the Bates decision, if I'm not mistaken, that it's subject to review. Where's the review if you're directed?
Your Honor, we believe that a combination of the statutes that we cited, including 511, give the secretary inherent authority to exercise his discretion and to stay cases. Your Honors, the secretary has not thumbed his nose at the precedent of this court. Nothing about the secretary's stay defies the precedential value.
Let me ask you a question,
yes, Your Honor.
Sort of along those lines. When would the secretary apply Haas to other cases? At what point in time would the secretary apply Haas to other cases?
When rendering its decisions. The secretary has not...
No. Right now, the secretary is not applying Haas.
Okay, I understand.
When would the secretary apply Haas?
Your Honor, the duration of the stay here is reasonable.
How, and what point in time is that? Will the stay be lifted?
Yes, Your Honor. The cases dealing with the discretion to stay do not...
I'm talking about this case.
Yes, Your Honor. It's
a specific question. When will that stay be lifted?
Yes, Your Honor. Though the stay of the board decision-making in accordance with Haas is not set to expire on a specific date, it is reasonable because due to the federal...
I didn't ask you if it's reasonable. I said, when is it going to expire?
Yes, Your Honor. And if I could finish answering, the answer is when the law is settled. That is when the court to which the legal issue in Haas has been presented...
Is that after the federal circuit?
Decision.
So
is that after the federal circuit? After the Supreme Court? After an attempt to change it in Congress?
Well, right now the appeal is before the Federal Circuit, and so that's what we're talking about.
So are you telling us that when the Federal Circuit decides the case, assuming it, however it's decided, it will apply the Federal Circuit's decision? Is that the time period we should measure for reasonableness?
Yes, Your Honor.
Then how is that different than saying we will never apply a decision of this court with which the Secretary disagrees and which they've appealed to the Federal Circuit? Isn't that saying that, in other words, if we disagree with the decision and we won't apply it until the Federal Circuit makes a decision, while in different words, how is that not dressed up and really you're saying, we don't agree with the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims decision and we want to appeal it, we're never going to apply that decision until another court tells us we have to.
Your Honor, that is not the position that the Secretary has taken. And that's very similar to the example of this court's own stay of bilateral tinnitus cases. This court's own stay while the Supreme Court rules on the petition for certiorari.
That was in response to a joint request by the parties. In this case, we have a disputed petition. We have parties that are not in agreement. That is an appropriate situation. Here you have a party, Mr. Roboto, who's saying, look, I don't want my case held up. I'm in ill health, and I fit perfectly within Haas. Don't hold me up. So there's a dispute here. It's different than the stay with regard to Smith.
Your Honor, I don't understand. With respect to the Smith stay, it's not my understanding that all parties to cases affected by the court's order consented to the stay. Rather, it seems that the court exercised the reasonable...
If that's the case, I misspoke.
The reasonable exercise of its inherent authority, the same authority that the Supreme Court addressed in Landis and all those other cases.
Do we have a 7107?
Sir?
Do we have a 7107 that applies to us?
No, Your Honor, and as we...
You keep avoiding it, but it sits there.
Your Honor, I'm not trying to avoid 7107. Our position is that reading of 7107 would be incongruent with the other statutes.
But that reading puts no limitations on it then. There are no limitations then. The Secretary decides he wants to stop it because he wants the law changed. He'll just go to the board chairman and say, stop processing.
And when does the Secretary decide to exercise this authority? What criteria does he use? There are plenty of cases that are decided adversely to the Secretary in this court that the Secretary chooses to appeal, but a stay is not imposed. What criteria does the Secretary use to determine when it's going to impose a stay?
The criteria that he uses is the exercise of his authority. And there have to be good reasons for it, Your Honor. And this court, as it sits and determines whether the exercise of that authority was so unreasonable as to warrant a writ, that's this court's role. Now, there were a number of excellent reasons that support the exercise of the stay in this case, Your Honor, and I'd like to address those.
Well, before you do that, let's back up to Smith and the exercise of the Secretary's discretion in Smith. In Smith, the Secretary originally stayed the cases at the board. And then when this court's decision was reversed at the Federal Circuit, what did the Secretary do?
The Secretary lifted the stay, Your Honor.
And processed the cases as denials, am I correct?
And processed the cases as denials, yes, Your Honor.
And in that context, would you please tell me what in the factors that the Secretary cited changed from the time that this court rendered its decision in Smith to the time that the Federal Circuit rendered its decision in Smith, those factors being the same factors cited here? Delays avoid burdens on the adjudication system. delays in the adjudication of other claims, and unnecessary expenditure of resources through remand or final adjudication of claims. And I point out, as I'm sure counsel knows, that there is a pending petition for a writ of certiorari in the Supreme Court seeking to reverse the Federal Circuit in Smith. So how did those factors change in their weight when the Secretary looked at a different outcome?
I just add to that that under the statutory provision you cited to, the decision is not yet final because of that.
That's correct, Your Honor. Under 7291, while a decision is on appeal, it is not binding and final as to the parties. But that doesn't affect its precedential value. Your Honor, this case is not about why the Secretary employed his inherent authority in Smith and why he decided to lift the stay as to...
Well, it is about whether or not there's arbitrary action, isn't it?
It's about whether his exercise of the stay in this case was reasonable, and it was, Your Honor. And there are a number of reasons that support that, and I'd like to address those before closing.
Mr. Ripple, I'm just a simple country lawyer, and I'm trying to figure out the criteria that you're talking about the Secretary uses is basically if the Secretary disagrees with the decision, in my simplistic view of the world. And why wouldn't the department take the position as well that if you disagree with the Federal Circuit decision, then you will wait until the Supreme Court decides to grant or deny certiorari until you lift a stay? Going back to Judge Hagel's question regarding specifically when would the stay be lifted. Following your logic, the Secretary can decide to do what the Secretary wants to do with decisions of this court and the federal court until ultimately the Supreme Court decides. And perhaps if the Secretary doesn't like that decision, he can appeal to Congress and have those cases held pending change of law. Isn't that an abuse of discretion?
Your Honor, it would be an abuse of discretion if the exercise of the Secretary's inherent authority was unreasonable. And this court would be in a position, if aggrieved parties came before it, to evaluate under the immoderate and of an indefinite duration rule, whether the stay at that point in time was unreasonable. And if the stay was unreasonable, this court would be poised to exercise its all writs.
Are the factors that you keep wanting to get to that we've read in your brief, are they not true in basically every case that it is adverse to the Secretary, that if it were reversed, it would result in re-adjudication, that there would be expense associated with that adjudication, that it would create potentially disparate classes of veterans receiving or not receiving benefits? Isn't that true in every case that is adverse to the Secretary?
Your Honor.
And can I just add to that? Isn't it true in every case that we render a decision in that the Federal Circuit then reverses, even if our decision was favorable to the Secretary, it could get reversed at the Federal Circuit, and you'd still have the same complications that Judge Shalom just referred to?
If I could address these different points, Your Honors. First of all, there is no set list of criteria that the Secretary will consider in deciding whether to use his inherent state authority over the Board's docket. Rather, the considerations that we addressed in our brief are those that support the reasonableness of the exercise of his stay powers here. And, Your Honor, in looking at when the Secretary has exercised these in the past, I think speaks volumes about the prudence that he has used in exercising this authority, Your Honors. There have been very rare times when the Secretary has done this, Your Honors.
Counselor, let me ask you this. Let's step back and take a little longer view of this. You're familiar with Rule 8 of the Federal Rules of Appellate Procedure,
yes,
right?
Sir.
And what burden would be imposed upon the Secretary if, as an example, in the Haas case, he came to this court and said, this is the impact, we intend to appeal this. It's going to have repercussions throughout the system, 1,600 cases, and we're seeking leave to appeal and delay the effective date of this decision, please. It doesn't sound like a huge burden on a secretary to ensure that there is some judicial oversight in this otherwise unregulated process.
But, Your Honor, those rules do not require. What those rules provide for is the ability of a losing party to come to the court and attempt to stay judgment in a particular case. they do not give any court authority over the docket in another court or another body when those cases are not on appeal before it.
Well, that leads me to the second long-range view. In 1988, Congress passed the Veterans Judicial Review Act, as I recall. And you're suggesting that it only applies on a retail basis and not a wholesale basis. And this court is powerless to take a look at the internal operating procedures of the Secretary to ensure that due process and fundamental fairness are, in fact, being abided by over there. Would you agree with that?
No, Your Honor, I would not agree.
Okay. So you're suggesting that maybe Congress needs to revisit the Veterans Judicial Review Act in order for us to be able to take a look at the internal procedures of the Secretary to ensure veterans of this country are getting their due. Is that it?
Your Honor, what I would say is that this court does have the authority to look at the reasonableness of the Secretary's exercise when a case is brought before it, Your Honor. And the Secretary's prudent and rare use of this authority to stay cases speaks volumes, Your Honor.
Mr. Ripple, you recall I asked Mr. Stichman a question at the beginning of his argument regarding why he thought the Secretary did not come to this court and request to stay, and his answer was, I think that's a question that might be better put to the Secretary. And so let me put it to you as well. It's a simple process. Why didn't the Secretary simply come to this court in Haas and say to this court in a motion that a stay would be helpful?
Your Honor, the answer to that question is because that procedure would require the Secretary to come and ask the court's permission to exercise his inherent authority to manage the docket before him. So, Your Honor, we would respectfully disagree with the fundamental idea that the Secretary has to come to the court to exercise his authority, because what that would essentially be doing is giving this court the authority to either stay or to withhold a stay.
As I understand, it's your view that the court does not have the authority to stay the processing of cases below.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Can you compare
what action the Federal Circuit took in the Nova cases? Did the Federal Circuit also not have authority to stay the processing of those cases?
No, Your Honor. We would disagree with that for the same reason, although in a different context, but. Before, with respect to my question about the Niemer stays, I was addressing the fact that Niemer involved a class. All the parties to the class were before the court, and therefore that court had the authority to stay those cases. In a different context, but similarly, Your Honor, the Nova litigation involves a direct rulemaking challenge under 502. And in such challenges, there is no question that the Federal Circuit has jurisdiction over the rulemaking. In that litigation, the Federal Circuit did not articulate any other basis except for 502 for its authority to stay cases affected by the rulemaking challenge. The Federal Circuit stayed cases that would be affected by the rulemaking, Your Honors, to preserve its continuing jurisdiction over the Department's rulemaking, and that stay is still in place. The nature of the Federal Circuit's retained jurisdiction over cases affected by rulemaking challenges under 502 is unlike this court's jurisdiction over adjudications. Your Honors, this court has no such continuing jurisdiction.
But isn't there a difference, Counselor, between this court deciding to stay its effective date of a decision versus attempting to control the department's or the board's docket?
Your Honor, we don't believe there's a distinction because the end result would be the exact same.
If you do say, however, right, as I understand your position then, is that the Secretary's discretion is not unreviewable.
That's correct.
It is, in fact, reviewable, but it ought to be reviewed at some point in time when the stay appears to some veteran to be too long, let's say. Then that veteran should come here to this court and say, hey, the stay is too long. Lift the stay, and at that point, the court would review the exercise of discretion.
Yes, Your Honor. That's how it works in the federal judicial system, and that's how it should work here, Your Honor.
Mr. Ripple, thank you. We held you a little longer, but
happy to answer questions.
You may be able to stay even longer than that. thank you. Mr. Stichman?